Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
I don't want a lot for Christmas.
No,
that is your fault.
No.
I would like you to know that I just finished listening to yesterday's show.
You also know, and I said I could hum a few bars, but no. You know why I did that? Because I'm a compassionate human being, that's why.
All I want for Christmas.
It doesn't even matter. The thing is, it doesn't even matter, because all you have to do is say it, and it's over.
Nope. Have some damn discipline, would you please?
Hello, everyone. It's Molly Wood.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. This, of course, is Make Me Smart, where we get smarter together about tech, the economy, and culture. And as we like to say around here, none of us is as smart as all of us.
And this is one of those episodes that sort of hits on all three of those things,
wow,
tech, the economy, and culture. I know. Hat trick. if you have been to Burger King or Dunkin' Donuts or even the grocery store lately, you have noticed a new addition to the menu, meat replacement. And also, if you've been watching things like the stock market, specifically, though, you've probably seen the Beyond Burger and the Impossible Burger everywhere these days. In fact, I can tell you that my son and his dad arrived at my house just the other night with a taste test.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. They brought the, like, whatever the one is from Burger, the Impossible Whopper and a regular one.
Oh, wow.
And
all right. Wait. Let's save the results.
Yep, I'm going to zip
it. Let's save the results.
Yep,
that's
okay.
Totally fascinating because I have not partaken. But the reason we're doing this is basically because of the planet. Meat is super popular. It's a huge industry. It's amazingly popular in America, but it's also not great for the planet. It's not great for the animals in question. But the thing that's happening is that we as consumers in this economy and globally too are caring more about our food, where it comes from, and what it means. And so we have wound up this thing called a meat replacement industry, which is booming. As Molly was talking about, Beyond Meat is a publicly traded company. Impossible's getting there. They're worth billions of dollars. They are in ever more places. I frankly did not know they were in Dunkin' Donuts. I didn't actually even know Dunkin'
sold
either, real meat.
Because I thought just had donuts. Yeah.
Anyway, so that's what we're doing today.
Donut replacements. today, yes, we're going to talk about that. We're going to, and it is not without controversy, of course, the meat replacement industry, whether it's pushback from the meat industry or questions about what is actually in there. So we're going to talk about plant-based substitutes, lab-grown meat and cultured meat. And we will even talk about that other key protein source that everyone forgets about, but is coming our way, edible insects, doing it all.
Really? We're doing that? Edible insects?
Yeah.
Do we have to?
Yep.
All right. Well, we will if we have to. Anyway, Molly and I, we can blather about this for a little while, but there's an actual expert on the other end of the phone who's going to help us through this. Her name is Larissa Rudenko. She's a research affiliate at the Program on Emerging Technologies up at MIT. Larissa, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
Interesting to be talking about technology when it comes to meat. That's the first thing that struck me.
It is indeed. And it's interesting that you should bring that up, because depending on where you sit and how you look at sources of food, you can see that some people think that it's a very low-tech kind of business and other people think it's a very high-tech kind of business. And the reality is that depending on what it is you're eating or growing or processing, it can be either or both at the same time.
Yeah, and we have talked a little bit before, actually. Larissa was a guest on Marketplace Tech talking about these technologies and how the growth happens. But I think let's go back to the money for just a minute. How big of an industry do you think meat replacement has become and potentially could become? How big a deal is this?
Yeah, this is a really big deal. So I tend to look at the market basically as being bifurcated and then a little bit more on the other side. So there's the plant-based replacements for meat. And then there's going to be the cultured meat or lab-grown meat or clean meat or whatever people are calling it component. And then there's going to be other sources of protein, as you mentioned, the insect, edible insects. And they have their pluses and minuses. But we already know, based on how the market and the public has reacted to plant-based meat products, that it's going to be huge. Beyond Meat opened at 60-something, went up to about 250, then everybody sold their shares. It dropped down, and for the last few weeks, it's been sort of hovering in the mid-70s, which is probably where it might need to be based
on
sales.
Totally respectable, right? I mean, totally respectable.
Totally respectable.
Yeah.
Impossible is not on the market yet, but there are lots of legacy companies that have been making plant-based meat replacements for a very long time. And I guess part of the question is this going to be a rising tide that raises all boats, or is this going to be a riptide that's going to get rid of a lot of the legacy players? I don't know what the answer is to that.
All right. So can we get to the taste test here, Molly?
Yes. Okay. So I recently, I tried the Impossible Whopper is the one they have at Burger King. There were like five of us in the house. My brother was over and my sister-in-law, and everybody tried it. And everyone failed the taste test.
Really? So they couldn't tell real from veggie
thought,
or whatever.
Yeah. In fact, we all identified the Impossible Whopper as the real burger.
Wow.
Every one of us. Yep. I mean, they really, and that must be, Larissa, some part of the reason why this is working, because really, you know, these it's not like a veggie burger where you're eating some sort of bean thing and you know it. It really is attempting to replace meat. That's a bit of a shift, right?
It is indeed. And I think what the people who are trying to make a business out of these things are doing is not appealing to the vegetarians or vegans, but appealing to everybody else. Sometimes the term flexitarian is used. I don't happen to like that term. I like omnivore, people who eat everything. And if you're concerned about meat intake and the impact of meat on the hoof on the planet, then this could be an extremely attractive alternative. But the taste test is really interesting. The Good Food Institute, which is a not-for-profit organization that is responsible for a lot of the regulatory, I wouldn't call it lobbying per se, but responsible for a lot of the research that's
perhaps
being done. It's influencing,
yeah.
But it's a big umbrella organization.
Right.
Anyway, they have an annual meeting every year. And the thing that's great about going to the meeting is you get to taste everything that people are making, because they're hot and cold running meat replacement products at every break in all kinds of forms.
Ew.
So you can have they're fine. I mean, you can have like a meatball, an Asian meatball, or you can have a breakfast burger, or you can have something that is another kind of mince. And so most of them taste really, really good.
Okay. Can we talk plant-based replacements versus lab-grown replacements, because they're not the same thing in difficulty and cost in all of these things. Do I have that right?
That's correct. Absolutely. So plant-based products basically take a plant crop that we have been eating for a long time, and through various modifications or technological changes, turn plant products into something that looks like and tastes like meat by the addition of various flavorings and processing the plant protein into a form that looks like meat. The thing that's different about lab-grown meat, and perhaps that's not really the best way of talking about it, because it's fermentation on a large scale, not on the lab scale, the same way that we use fermentation, for example, to make beer, is that it comes from cells from animals.
Yeah. This is relevant to guys'
interests. So it's going to be big vats, you know?
Oh, so, that's not appetizing, because if you're thinking about, you have to keep it appetizing. That's the thing. Big vats of goo that will eventually become meat. I hate to be that guy, but come on, right?
Better or worse than a slaughterhouse.
Yeah.
Well,
there you go.
Yeah, I guess. But all right, but look, here's the deal.
And all right, it's not a big vat of goo.
Fair enough. But look, Upton Sinclair aside, we've become acculturated to slaughterhouses, right? And yes, there's a rising awareness, and has been for decades now, of the horrible way that we process and treat food on the hoof. But that's different, in the consumer's eye, than a big vat of goo.
Well, I think we've all been through the pink slime episode, and I don't think we need to go there. So maybe we should, reframe this from the beginning.
Go ahead.
Let's start in the lab.
Okay.
Let's start in the lab. So one of the things that's really interesting about this field is that it's very similar to regenerative medicine in some ways. You basically start with a cell and you want to make a tissue or an organ that does what the larger organism would have done. So you basically have to take a cell that is used to be a muscle cell, and then you have to talk to it with chemicals and tell it to become a cell that hasn't decided what it's going to be yet. And then you talk to it with other chemicals, growth factors, normal growth factors that you would find in the body of people or any other organism, in this case, animal, and ask those cells to become, please, muscle cells or fat cells or connective tissue, and have them grow in the laboratory according to how you culture them. And this is not as easy as it sounds. It's very, very difficult to get those growth factors in the appropriate ratios and the appropriate timing so that you can make something that is either all muscle cell but also expresses some fatty acids that gives it the right mouthfeel, or you make muscle cells in one laboratory component and you make adipose or fat cells in another one and you put them together and they become sort of exactly like meat. So a lot of the people who are in this business don't say it's like meat. It is meat.
I wonder, do you think that long term, because, you know, what's been interesting about the plant-based meat replacement is that the pushback on that food is that it may not be that good for you and that people don't necessarily know what's in there. So do you think that long term figuring out that science of essentially growing meat without killing animals is the most, has the most potential?
I think it has an enormous potential, and I think it has potential not only for trying to solve. I mean, we have a huge problem coming up in the next 20 to 30 years. We need to feed 50 million more people. The climate is changing. We need to find some more sustainable way to do it. Plus, people are becoming extremely conscious about animal welfare issues. So, you know, this may be part of the solution to a huge problem. And the other thing to think about is, I mean, we all heard recently that two cultured meat companies, one a cultured beef product and the other a cultured fish product, recently were made in space. And if we're thinking about a trip to Mars, it's not always going to be Matt Damon on the planet saying, you know, we have to science the hell out of this. We have to science the hell out of how we're going to. I like using science as a verb.
I love,
love it.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have to science the hell out of how do you feed astronauts on a multi-year voyage?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's all well and good, and here I slip into my customary role, as you can tell by the preparatory sighs. So it's all well and good that the three of us and many millions of other people on the upside scale of this economy here and in Europe and in parts of Asia are having these conversations. But if I need to feed my family and I'm a subsistence farmer anywhere in the world, or I don't have the means to buy a heavily designed and engineered piece of meat, whether it's plant-based or otherwise, how much good are we really doing? I guess my question is, what's the tipping point, right? Because it can't just be the upside scale of the economic spectrum doing this.
I think if you're talking about trying to make this accessible to people of more modest means,
Because, look, there are more billions of people of modest means than there are billions of people of substantive means, right? And so we got to get everybody
absolutely
on the same train.
Absolutely. I think the difficulty is that when technologies emerge, one of the things that happens is that there are adopters and there are naysayers. Mm-hmm. And so, and there, the people often who are naysayers are those whose livelihoods are being threatened by the emergence of this new technology. So when you hear people in farming states, people who have been cattle ranchers or other kinds of meat producers for generations, which is operate in an extremely honorable kind of way, what you're basically saying is we don't like you, we don't like what you're doing, and we're going to find a new way to get to the consumer what you've been doing for generations. So there are lots of ethical issues that we need to think about when we talk about these alternative protein replacements that don't simply revolve around animal welfare or carbon footprints, but also revolve around what are we going to do about the people who already are making these kinds of foods. And I think we make a mistake if we're thinking about this as an or kind of question. You're going to eat plant-based or cell-cultured meat or nothing. I think it's actually you're going to eat those and you're going to eat what is currently on the market. Because the costs right now are too high. The technology is not well enough developed, at least in the cell culture meat component, that you can scale this at an affordable rate.
Even, I mean, I will say even the meat replacement, like I have gotten a little bit hooked on the Beyond Meat hot Italian sausages. They're delicious. Mm. They kind of taste like chorizo, but without the grossness factor. But I don't buy the very, I mean, they're like $9.50 for a pack of four sausages,
right.
I think, or something like that. You know, it's, but I think that is sort of a pretty standard path in technology, expensive at first and cheaper later.
Right. And then, you know, we still don't know how to do the full life cycle analysis because nobody's gone completely to scale. So everything that we do in those analyses is based on uncertainties, assuming that this is going to scale up to the 10,000 liter stage or the 10,000 pound stage in this way versus that way. And then there are the externalities associated with the economics of just generating that whole product market.
Do you think this is the moment, though? Is this the tipping point moment?
I think we're right at the precipice of the tipping point. I do, because the initial acceptance has been high. The technology is developing well. There are more and more companies getting into this space. I think last year there were, 20-something cell-cultured meat companies, and now they're in the 40s. And there's a lot of money going into this, a lot of venture money, a lot of philanthropic funds, a lot of people with lots of money like Bill Gates and Richard Branson are all getting into this field and helping fund some of these things. And there's a lot of excitement. I mean, this is not a product that being developed by baby boomers, you know, it's a different generation of people who are developing this kind of stuff. And it's so exciting to be around these people because they're so enthusiastic and so smart and trying to figure out lots of interesting kinds of things. But, you know, you do have to think about the flip side as well.
I do want to ask you, I feel like while I have you, everyone's going to want to know the answer to this question because there has been controversy and some of it could be, you know, propaganda about what is in Beyond Meat and Impossible Meat. And I was hoping that you could help us understand it. Like, what is the deal with the pea protein? And are there indeed a bunch of chemicals in there that make them less healthy than meat might be?
Well, I'm sorry. I have to put on my scientist hat and say that pea protein is a chemical.
Okay. But, there we go.
Okay, given that pea protein is actually a chemical and is made up of lots of chemicals, there are lots of processing aids, and there are flavor ingredients and additional vitamins that are put in to make what is essentially tofu taste like meat, right? So whether you do it afterwards by dressing your meat with spices and whatever, your tofu with spices to make it taste a little more like meat, or you do it in the process of making these things, that's kind of, pardon the pun, chicken and egg kind of thing.
I heard you try to avoid that, and it was heroic.
And then I thought, no, this is too good to pass up.
Go with it.
So, gotta run. So, I think the question of whether it's something that's good for you or not, depends on how you're going to look at that question. A regulatory agency might say, how is this different from any food that we eat now or any components of foods that we eat now? And is it as safe as food that we eat now? Or they may say this is an entirely new component or a new growth factor that we haven't seen before at a particular dose, so you have to have pre-marketing approval for it. And I'm just talking about the United States. But there are lots of regulatory agencies around the world who are trying to wrap themselves around this and how do we do this? And so no one has actually done a whole bunch of nutritional studies yet that have been published. I'm sure there are some underway. But I guess the point is that if you're going to eat everything Do you eat everything all in one serving, or do you eat it out of, you know, over the course of the day?
Hmm. Right. Larissa Rudenko is a research affiliate in the program on emerging technologies at MIT. She is the one who knows all about this topic. Larissa, thanks so much for coming back on.
My pleasure, and it's great to meet you both again.
Thanks a bunch.
Take care.
All right, so I think I'm going to go with the sausages. I will try the sausages. How about that?
Oh, they're super
all
good.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Can I get them at Ralph's, do we think?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right.
They're everywhere. I get them the little bodega around the corner, and they have them at Whole Foods. I'm sure they have them at Ralph's.
Okay.
I got to say, like, they're my favorite thing with eggs, and then they're really good in pasta.
All right.
Brilliant, those little sausages.
What about just, like, pulling them off the grill and eating them? Do you have to? Whatever. Anyway.
Yeah, you can do that, too.
All right, we're going to do that. Oh, look, and I got stuff.
Oh.
Wow.
Is it treat
time? We have
cookies.
What? Oh, my God. So we have cricket powder, too.
What?
Well, so here's
the deal. Wait, what?
Yeah.
So
we said bugs up on top. Open the box. Open the box.
Oh.
Open the box. It's 100% pure cricket powder.
We didn't even want to talk about the bug thing.
Now we know why Sam was like, Sam was in the Slack. He was like, don't forget the bugs. And Molly and I are like, yeah, I don't care about bugs. So here we go now.
Stinkers.
Cricket powder. So are these, wait, somebody tell me these aren't cricket flour cookies. Tony's like, oh, Sam gave you up. All right. So do I have to eat
them
now?
I'm not going to lie.
I guess I kind of do.
The box that I just got looks like it has live crickets in it. I'm holding this up.
All right. I got a little cup of coffee.
I'm glad you said that there are cookies in here because this looks like a container that could contain a cricket.
Okay. Oh, my goodness. All right. So I'm going to read this. I'm going to read this little Slack we got.
Here's what it says.
You ready? It's a surprise taste test. When we were planning this episode, Marketplace Special Projects producer Eliza Mills suggested a more realistic way humans will likely eat insects is folded into food rather than just munching on whole bugs, which is basically the way you get kids to eat vegetables. You wrap it up in like some kind of treat. Anyway, so more appetizing, more sustainable added protein. So Sam acquired some cricket flour, of which we have some here. Two batches of Christmas cookies, one with normal sugar cookie recipe and one with a third of a flour swapped for pure ground crickets. Kai has the packaging and a cookie plate in the studio with him. Molly has three of each in a Tupperware that we shipped her. Give him a try, see if you can taste the cricket. So I don't know which is which, right? Or do you guys know which is which? Is there like a control set? Well, there has to be a control set, right? Somebody has to know.
Well, I'm going to assume that the ones that are kind of greenish-brown cricket color may be the cricket flour ones.
I don't think cricket color corresponds to color of flour. I'm just going to say
one is like totally normal.
All right.
Well, if it was like a ground-up bug, wouldn't it be kind of brown?
So you know what's great is I'm going to put these out in the kitchen later, and we're not going to put any warning on them.
Yeah,
and then
you
like maybe this afternoon, I'm going to send an all staff that says, oh, by the way, you ate bugs!
You ate bugs!
Okay. So
I
here's
will
a
tell
light
you,
and normal
I have
color
eaten actual cricket
color.
Legs. I've done it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's a
restaurant. This is gross eating on the microphone. I'm going to step away for a minute.
Okay, I'm going to try the ones that just look like regular sugar cookies.
What I was going to say was, when we were on survival training, we were eating everything. Everything. So,
did you eat a bunch of bugs?
Oh, bugs, snakes, you name it.
Yeah.
And then there was Rich Palumbo who woke up in the tent next to me the next morning and said, I want a Denny's Grand Slam breakfast. I want a goddamn Denny's Grand Slam breakfast.
I feel like this is such a representative example of what happens when you try to tell Kai a story. Like, oh, yeah, I went to this like fancy Latin American restaurant in downtown Oakland and they garnish things with cricket legs. And it was lovely. And I just, you know, took my car there and then I came home. And then Kai's like, oh, that one time that I had to live in the jungle.
Oh, come on.
In my underwear for a week with my muscle car. And then... and I had to spear a snake and garnish it with some bugs that I picked up.
It was a tiny little snake. It was not very appetizing. All right, so that was the regular flour one. It was yummy. Whatever.
Yep.
Here comes the
bug
one.
Now I'm trying this darker colored one.
All right.
I'm going to later.
Yeah, no. Can't tell the difference. No chance.
It's a little gamey. I'm just saying, look at the color difference here. I'm holding these up to my camera. You'll be able to see this on YouTube later. Just FYI, if you go to YouTube, you can see Make Me Smart tapings. I mean,
maybe
one of them tastes slightly saltier and like maybe kind of meaty.
Yeah.
But we should have done it blind, actually. We should have, yeah, because the color difference is
real. I'm not opening the bag and getting a whiff of the flour, Tony. I'm not doing that. Not doing that.
Oh, I didn't get a bag of the flour. I'm not going to lie. I'm getting some aftertaste, but I think it could be these weird sprinkle things on top of the cookies.
Well, I'm getting the aftertaste. You know what? This is all power of suggestion. We're talking ourselves into an aftertaste. That's what
we really are. I know, exactly. Okay, right. I'm going to I don't like that aftertaste, but I actually am pretty sure that it's actually just the weird chemical thing of the sprinkles.
All right, I'm going to have some cold stale coffee. That'll be better.
If it's cricket. I should have brought coffee. I only have water.
Well, mine's cold and stale, but now I don't have cricket taste in my mouth.
I mean, guys, I will say kudos to you producers, and I can now understand why there was some urgency about me getting this package today.
Also, we will get all kinds of emails and tweets from people who will say, in essence, grow the hell up, right? Did I just get the E? I got us the E again, didn't I? Oh, I guess I did.
Come on.
Rich Palumbo survival.
Larissa said HE double toothpicks also.
Okay. All right. Well, there we go.
We will definitely get emails from a lot of people who were like, there is no way in HE double toothpicks that I would have taken a bite of a cookie that I thought was made with cricket powder. I think we are very brave. Very brave.
But also, don't take our word for what you will say. Why don't you say it yourselves? Send us a voice memo if you like, or you can just send us a regular email and we'll read it. Take your pick. You know, speak up. Well, be proud. Have a voice.
And please don't send us those emails that are like, you know, people in starving countries would be happy to have a cricket. Because we know. MakeMeSmart@Marketplace.org. We'll be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, my goodness.
That would have been amazing.
Oh, my God. All right. Let's get this show on the road, man.
There
it is.
Oh.
Oh, my goodness.
The show is the road.
And that is what we call a sting in the audio production biz. It's a very short one. It brings us back. It's brief, and it gets us to the point. And the point is, what is in the news that is on our minds? You want to go first?
I do, actually. Okay. Right. And this is, I changed my news fix at the last moment due to a near snafu related to the taste test that we just did. Because these cookies were supposed to show up via FedEx yesterday, and then these cookies were supposed to show up via FedEx at 8 o'clock this morning. And at my PO box, she was like, "Yeah, there was no tag." And then FedEx was like, "Oh no, we totally tried to deliver it at 7:30, but no one was there." And I was like, "FedEx leaves a tag," and she was like, "Yeah, this is my whole job is operating a postal depot. They leave a tag." So then I finally got the cookies like 5 minutes before the show. As you know, we started like 2 minutes late, and you know.
Anyway.
But anyways, the whole thing. And then it reminded me that I literally just saw this story this morning about how Amazon has basically banned FedEx from its platform. It will no longer allow third-party sellers to use FedEx Ground Delivery. You can pay a whole bunch and use their express service. Right. But you can't use FedEx Ground because Amazon is like, look, you don't deliver on time.
Yeah. And also now, competition, right? I mean, Amazon has its package delivery service and all that, right? So
yes, exactly. Yeah. So the caveat here is that Amazon is a competing shipper, and that is true. But I cannot deny a simple Twitter search will turn up a whole bunch of rants about FedEx. I cannot deny that FedEx has not risen to the competition.
Yeah, I think that's totally true. Yep.
And I think like that is the difference between a business that survives disruption and a business that does not. Yep. And FedEx somehow, I don't know if they have refused to make the investment but there was a whole, you know, New York Times story about FedEx and how it's like fallen apart, and then the CEO challenged them to like a debate.
Oh, but well, that was Fred Smith. He's the chairman. He's a crotchety old dude. Also the founder of that company. Yeah, but no, that's totally right. And here's the other thing, though, right? The flip side of FedEx not measuring up is that the thing that Bezos says all the time, which is every day is day one at this company. We have to prove ourselves. We have to go the extra mile. We have to do customer service. And that's sort of what they're doing.
Yeah. And there are, you see those companies, you know, I think, was it Hertz back in the 80s or 90s that was like, we try harder.
Right.
And that became their, that became not only their slogan, but sort of their mission.
Yep.
And I just, it just got me thinking about the nature of disruption and competition and what companies rise to it and which ones don't. And you even you saying, you know, that the CEO of FedEx is just a crabby, like, stuck in his ways guy. Well, it's like, well, you know what? Maybe it was time to
unstick,
make a change.
Yeah.
Make a change.
For sure.
Because I almost didn't get my cookies.
and your bugs. did you get a packet of flour too, by the way? Cricket flour?
I didn't get the flour. I just got the Cricket cookies.
All right.
Cricket cookies, it's like cookies 40, is kind of catchy.
Do you,
wait,
so
what?
Nobody heard that. Cricket flour is apparently is 40 bucks, tiny little bag. I don't even know how big this is. How
really?
Big is this bag? It is 16 ounces, 1 pound.
That's the early pound, adopter right? punishment
yes.
right there.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's bananas.
40 bucks.
40 bucks. That's a lot. Cookies weren't good enough for $40 flour, I'm just saying. All right. So
it's not the recipe.
That's right. The thing that I'm a little fixated on is the story I saw in the New York Times up in your neck of the woods, Molly, this multimedia story they did about this homeless camp in Oakland right next to a Home Depot. It's a huge parking lot. Three, or I guess two, right? A reporter and a photojournalist from the New York Times went in there and spent 3 months documenting life in this homeless encampment, which if you know anything about California, you know that homelessness is a really big problem here. It's growing enormously in the past couple of years. And so they went in and they documented life and they talked about the community and shared services that they're doing for each other and all of these things. Completely tragic. I can't recommend it highly enough. It's really well shot and videoed and greatly reported, and it's just terrible.
And they went to, for comparison's sake, because these homeless encampments in Oakland and all around Northern California and even Southern California, the UN official recently compared them to, you know, slums in Mexico and Brazil and some, you know. And they went to one of the slums that it was compared to in Mexico where there's electricity. Like people have installed, you know, the government has essentially turned this sort of blind eye while people have installed electricity and running water and toilets in the shanties more than, more services than exist in these homeless encampments in Oakland and San Francisco and around this area where people not only have access to basic services, but are like regularly rousted out by city officials who are just like, sorry, you can't live here. I mean, we should be beyond embarrassed. That this is like, and I can tell you that when I drive around Oakland, like it is basically like watching an ongoing human rights violation. It's horrifying, and it's unacceptable. It's unconscionable to allow people to live like this in America, in one of the richest areas of the world. Full stop. Appalling, appalling, and people don't even know what to do. Like, you don't even know what to do. How many people are you supposed to drive by on a given day and just, you know, try to make the moral trade-off that's like, I guess I have to let you die a little bit today because I don't have cash. I don't know. Anyway, yes, you should look at it. Like, you should look at it and get pissed.
Read the
Dang
piece.
Dang it. Sorry. Oh.
Read the piece. Nah, it's all good. It's all good.
Also, it's all beautiful. Good. The piece is beautiful.
Yeah, it's just really well
done. Like, it's just so, yeah, it's just really well done. I'm glad you put it in because I almost put it in, and then I was like, "I'm going to rant about it."
I got in early, so I would beat you to it. In all honesty, I was like, "Oh, I got to get this in. Got to get this in." Okay, so awkward transition here,
awkward.
Which you know we kind of have to do, which is this mailbag's coming up in a minute. But wow, this is even super awkwarder than it really feels. But we kind of have to do it because we can't keep doing this, and we can't hear Molly's thoughts on homelessness and mine on whatever dark thing you can think of without y'all's support. And it's that time of year for our fundraiser. It's happening now.
Yeah.
Marketplace.org/donate. And something extra special, actually, that our development folks have been working on.
Yeah, this is clever and delightful. So once in a while, Kai and I and David Brancaccio from The Morning Report go to these events where we meet people who have donated to Marketplace and we get to hang out, and they're usually small. But they, you know, you got to fly to them. And so this year, our development people have come up with a way more clever version
yes.
of this experience.
Yes. Works
no
like
where
this.
You live. Yep.
Give $60 during this fundraiser or $5 a month. Take your pick. We will invite you to a Marketplace virtual AMA in 2020. We're going to do three of them. One of them is going to be Molly. One of them is going to be David. One of them is going to be me. Online, invite only, and looks behind the scenes at Marketplace and a chance to ask any of us anything, which is that whole AMA concept.
So fun. And again, pretty affordable. $5 a month or $60 all in one chunk during this fundraiser. Huh. I mean, that seems kind of cheap for like unlimited access to ask Kyra's all anything.
Do I have to answer anything?
I'm going to do it.
That's
I know.
The question.
Well, if I donate, will I get invited?
I don't know, but we should share our email thing this morning. So the development people.
I laughed so hard.
The development people blasted out an email this morning under Molly's signature, and it was like from Molly Wood. Subject: ask me anything. And then she laid out that whole thing about $60 a month, blah blah blah. Ask me anything, right? And so I wrote her back, and I said, "Dear Molly, longtime listener, first time caller, who invented liquid soap and why?" And she wrote me back. I have to pull it up now. Oh, my God. This is actually pretty funny. She wrote me back and said, "Dear Kai, you're my dog's favorite radio personality. He runs in a circle and barks whenever you say this is Marketplace. Can you tell me whether I should send a cashier's check to an investment expert in Nigeria? He says I can quadruple my money. Will there be tariffs on my earnings? Love the show." So you can ask us that stuff if you want or anything else.
I look forward to it. I feel like I've actually seen that dog thing. Like, I feel like that was an actual tweet or email that somebody
take your
sent
pick.
You.
I'm sure. Oh, my God.
Marketplace.org/donate. If you, too, would like to ask us anything. These AMAs will happen throughout 2020. But if you want to get in on them, you do have to sign up during this particular fundraiser before the end of the year. Get on it. Marketplace.org/donate. $5 a month or $60 up front. Brancaccio, Rizdahl, Wood, on the hot seat.
Boom. Moving on.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Which is exactly what we're going to do, something slightly yes. different. We're going to play one of y'all's voice memos and then roll with it from there. And yes, holiday themed.
But maybe related, because it yes. all started with a sustainability question that was sent in by our listener, DJ Colwell, and it goes like this.
Hey, Molly and Kai, which is better, real or fake Christmas trees? I grew up with real trees, and my fiancé and I have gotten real trees for our apartment every year because we like them. But I've seen some nice-looking fakes, and I'm wondering if that's a better choice. It seems like real trees would be better environmentally, since they provide all the benefits that trees do while they're still growing. That said, real trees are also heavier, which means more energy to ship, and unsold trees are wasted since they can't just be put into storage until next year. I'd also expect real trees probably require significantly more water to produce. I'll probably keep getting real trees unless I find out they're truly awful, but it would be nice to know some more about the impact of my choice.
Yeah, so nobody at me here, but I'm team real tree all the way. Just saying.
Yeah.
But here's what we did. Sam Anderson, producer, director extraordinaire, and Tony Wagner, producer, director, and digital guy, and also cookie baker and, hoodwinker of hosts with the cookies, with the flowers and the bugs.
Hoodwinker?
went to find the answer. Sam's here now, and he's going to tell us what he found. Sam?
Yeah, so there's more to it than you might think, but I did go on a little trip. I took a drive. I went to a place called Pelzer Pines in Brea, California. It's a super cute, like, cut-it-down-yourself place, which is, you know, the tradition that I grew up with, going to do it on our own with the family. And so they're a bit of a Christmas tree dynasty. They've been selling Christmas trees since the 60s. Wow. I spoke with Beth Pelzer, and I asked her to make the case for the real trees.
What's more sustainable, a real Christmas tree or an artificial one?
A real Christmas tree.
Why is that?
An artificial tree, when you're done and tired of it and you want to get a new one, what are you going to do? You're going to throw it away in the landfill. It is not biodegradable. A real Christmas tree is. It's not only that, but it's the fact that the Christmas trees are, you know, producing oxygen, too. So if you're covering up everything with concrete, you're taking away the natural, you know, substance that's going up and helping us breathe. A fake tree, just you're not going to smell the pine smell when you walk into your home. It just doesn't do it.
Amen.
That's okay, but to be fair, slightly biased perspective.
Obviously.
Yes, but it happens to be my perspective, so, you know.
No, I mean from her. Like she runs a Christmas tree farm.
I know. That's my perspective.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I agree. I'm believe me, couldn't be more on the same page here, but I'm trying to be I'm trying to be neutral.
All right. Well, so we'll make the case for the real trees, and then we'll talk about fake trees. And the real ones, you know, they do have a lot of benefits. A Christmas tree farm is like kind of like a forest, you know, not really, but they do create, you know, they sequester carbon and they create oxygen, right? You got animals, you got little critters living in there, deer and rabbits and whatever. Mm-hmm. So there's all these benefits to like just the actual place of the farm itself. They also grow them on like these rolling hillsides, which aren't great for other types of crops. So that gets a big benefit for the farmers because they can grow Christmas trees where they wouldn't be able to have productive land otherwise.
Okay. So that's the pro.
And so I did want to talk to some customers about why they were out there buying, you know, real trees. So we're going to play some of that tape, and then we'll hear from some guy who, you know, reviewed the fake trees. So we're going to play a clip. This is one of the customers I spoke to at Pelzer Pines.
Why did you choose to cut down your own tree?
Mostly nostalgia, I think. Just it's a fun thing, and you don't really get to cut trees down anymore. So.
And so have you ever thought about the sustainability of a real tree versus a fake tree?
Honestly, not really.
If you had to guess, what do you think would be better for the environment? Which one?
I would think a real tree because it's not plastic, it's not being made or causing pollution, and they're regrowing them, so.
Yeah. So where's the fake tree thing?
And so, you know, a lot of people say, okay, yeah, the fake tree, it's a big piece of plastic. It's going to end up in a landfill. But what it really boils down to is how long are you going to use this thing? Mm-hmm. Are you going to buy the $40 cheapo tree at Walmart and toss it after like 3 years? Or are you going to go for what he calls the Cadillac of Christmas trees, the $1,000 guy from Balsam Fir, which is a thing. You can spend more than $1,000 on an artificial Christmas tree, right? And so if you're going that route, that might be the more sustainable route, right? Because you're going to be using it over and over again. You'll save money eventually if you're buying a Christmas tree. Average price is about, for the real ones, you know, $75-$80 bucks. But for the fake ones, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be more upfront, but you will save some money.
All right. So this being Make Me Smart, let's get smart with an expert. You called one. What did he say?
We did call up Tim Heffernan. He's a senior staff writer at Wirecutter, which does consumer reports. He's done probably the most exhaustive review of artificial Christmas trees. Here's what he had to say.
Maybe the way to put it is, yeah, an artificial Christmas tree is a fairly significant purchase of something that's going to have a fairly significant environmental cost. Most of them will last a very long time. On the Balsam Hill, I could see 30 years. I mean, you'd have to take care of it, you know, store it properly, break it down properly every year. Probably makes people think about the environmental cost of artificial Christmas trees is that it's probably going to be the biggest and most obvious piece of plastic that you're ever going to buy, right? And it's sitting there in your living room and you're thinking, you know, geez, did I really need to do that? And what have I done? But again, versus the amount of gas you burn over the course of a year, the type and number of gifts you're putting under the tree, you know, those are kind of smaller everyday expenses that you can kind of just forget about. But those, for most people, are going to add up to a much greater impact than the artificial tree itself. It's a wash, I think.
Well, yeah, totally. I feel like that was damn them with faint praise for the real tree.
Right.
But I'm taking it as a wholehearted endorsement of the real tree. Yeah. Yay, it's
all
the
right.
best.
Let me do a little poll here, right? So we've got, how many people do we have in the control room? One, two, three, four people? Right? There are people sitting on the floor sometimes.
I think there's about four people in there.
All right,
right
four
now.
People in there plus you. Molly and I are real tree people, right? Yes? Molly?
Yes. Huge okay. real tree. Always
the five
way
of
too
you.
Large.
Show of hands, real trees.
Yeah, also a strong
two.
Real tree person.
Interesting. And the other three of you are fake tree people? Really?
Or maybe
but
no
ben,
tree people.
Ben told me
ben,
this year
ben
is the Talladay first time.
Shaking his head sheepishly or nodding his head sheepishly for the fake tree. Wow. All right.
But you know.
Oh, yeah. First year we've done fake,
first
he says.
Year.
Sure. Pal,
I am going to tell
sure.
you, like,
you
from
now
a
you
got to
keep it 30 years, dude. Got to keep it 30 years. That's all I'm saying.
Most Americans do actually keep the artificial trees, though. 80%.
Get out.
Artificial trees.
Seriously?
Yeah. Some people say the number's skewed because that's like all the trees that are presented. It might include like storefronts and stuff like that. But that is the number. That is like 80% of people have artificial trees.
Send us an email. What do you
yeah,
do?
Send
real
us.
Or fake? Just do it. One
I,
word. Real or fake?
I will say
fake.
That
that's
my mother outweighs all of my attempts at real tree because she puts up like 12 artificial trees every year. She owns like 12. Okay, I'm embarrassed
right.
I said that out loud. That's it for us. Goodbye.
Sam Anderson,
on
Christmas trees. Tony Wagner, thank you so much for the cookies and the work on the Christmas tree thing.
Yes.
Holy cow. All of which is to
producers.
Say this.
Producers.
Yes. What are we saying, Mollywood?
All of this to say is the producers have done all the work and now we're taking a break. No.
That's right. We're leaving. See ya.
This show will technically be on a break for a few weeks over the holiday, but while we're gone, you will still have episodes. We're going to respin updated versions of some of our favorite episodes from 2019. So it will not be, because you're going to want to listen. There's like predictions in there. There is new material in there and respins of some of our favorite interviews. So stay tuned for that.
Yes. Also, let us remember, if we could, that Make Me Smart is more than just this podcast. Daily explainers on your smart speaker, a weekly newsletter as well that comes out every Friday. You can sign up for that at marketplace.org/newsletters. And also, if you want to hear those explainers on your Echo device, I won't say the name because people yell at me, just say Make Me Smart and see what happens. Surprise. Trade deficit today, by the way.
Oh, good.
I know.
Fun.
I know.
Real Woo-hoo! Cheerful holiday.
That's awesome.
Topic.
Can't wait to hear more about the trade gap, Kai. Please, don't leave me waiting. Anyway.
Oh, my goodness. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner and Cookie Baker Extraordinaire. Our senior producer is Jody Becker. And thank you to our video producer, Ben Heathcote, and writer-producer, Erica Phillips.
This week's program was engineered by fake tree guy Ben Tolliday. Theme music was composed by fake tree guy Ben Tolliday. Also, Daniel Ramirez, whose tree preferences we really don't know. The executive director of On Demand is Star Nieves. Senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
Probably a good time to note that not everyone does trees because not everyone does Christmas.
Yes, that's true. That's
we know.
True.
Yeah, yes, which is
we know.
Which is
don't
the
at
case.
Us. Please. Yes.
Well, now I totally understand. Yep. That would have been a real bummer, although kind of hilarious if I was like, oh, I'm so sorry, Kai, my package didn't come. I guess you have to eat crickets alone.
That's what you should have done. After you discovered that it was cricket powder, you should have said, oh, I don't know. I didn't get it.
Oh, you know, it's so weird. FedEx.
The box was empty.
They're terrible.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.